It's Patricia Karpus, host of Untangle, the award-winning podcast that covers topics like optimizing brain health, finding your purpose, how to sleep better, harnessing the power of anxiety, successfully changing habits, finding more happiness and joy, and overall, all the many ways to live your best life. If you enjoy hearing from thought leaders, neuroscientists, psychologists, nutritionists, business leaders, and more, join us wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Addicted Mind podcast. My name is Dwayne Osterlin, and I'm your host, and we are on to another episode. So today, my guest is Justin B. Long, and he is author of The Righteous Rage of a 10-Year-Old Boy, A Journey of Self-Discovery. So today, Justin and I talk about his journey through his own trauma, childhood trauma, and how that set him up for alcoholism, to escape that. And also we're going to talk about the traps of getting stuck in that idea of toxic masculinity, where as men, we can't share our feelings, we can't be vulnerable, we should just be stoic at all times, and how that keeps us stuck from being able to heal from our past wounds. Great conversation with Justin. He is just an open book, shares his story, talks about it, and shares his hope and healing for everyone else out there who is struggling with some of the same issues. And if you are enjoying the Addicted Mind podcast, please share it with a friend or write a review in iTunes. That really does help people find the podcast. All right, everyone. Let's go ahead and start this episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Addicted Mind podcast. My guest today is Justin Long, and he is going to talk about his book, The Righteous Rage of a 10-Year-Old Boy. I love the title, and I'm excited to talk about it, and I'm excited to hear your story. So, Justin, let's just jump in and introduce yourself.
All right. Well, thanks for having me on the show, Dwayne. I'm very excited to be here. And as you said, my name is Justin B. Long, not to be confused with the actor Justin Long.
But there you go.
I am a little older and not near as wealthy as he is.
There you go.
But I'm working on it. Right. I'm working on it.
You're working on it. All right. Well, let's just jump in. Let's start to hear a little bit of your story of recovery. And we're going to talk about how you got to your book, too.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So tell me about you. How did this all start?
Well, I don't really know where it started, to be honest with you, because it's one of those stories that starts in a lot of different places. But I became aware of what was happening in my life in my mid-30s when I was trying to recover from alcoholism. But since then, you know, that journey has taken me back to the beginning of time and understanding what it was that drove me to alcoholism to begin with. And a lot of that was events in my childhood. And I grew up with two very emotionally dysfunctional parents. And my dad was a workaholic and a rageaholic. And my mom was deep off into extreme religiosity, hoping that God was going to solve her emotional challenges. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, I guess, for a kid, because my parents didn't have any emotional tools to support me or to help me grow up in a healthy way. So I grew up with, you know, my dad, you know, just him working wasn't enough. I had to work all the time too, I think, for him to feel good about what he was doing. But, you know, right. He would have this long list of chores for me to do every day when I got home from school. And then when he got home from work, we would go inspect all those chores and I would get a spanking for all the shortcomings in them. So I had these impossible expectations that I could never meet, with guaranteed punishment at the end of the day, every day. And that kind of stuff taught me that I'm going to be a failure no matter what I do. You know, no matter how hard I try, I'm going to get punished, and that there's no point in me even trying. But I still tried because I needed that impossible carrot, right? That pat on the back that I finally did good and I'm going to get through today without a spanking.
And you said spanking, but in reading your book, I think that's a little bit of an understatement. If, you know, in some of your stories you write, a spanking doesn't really sound like the right level.
Sometimes it was a spanking. Sometimes it was a lot worse than that. I think it would depend on how angry my dad was at any given day. But, you know, sometimes it was 5 or 6 swats. Sometimes it was 20 or 30. The time the trash can got dumped in the backyard, it was 104. So, you know, it varied in intensity, but it was never a mild swat on the butt. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. So how do you feel this led to your drinking, all of this trauma?
I think that, you know, between that and my mom, who would, you know, put me in the trash dumpster to wait until my dad got home to spank me for whatever I'd done to her, you know, that I just had these beliefs about myself that were very negative. And I believed that I was worthless, that I wasn't good enough, that I could never do anything right. And so by the time I was a teenager, you know, I was looking for any way out of my skin because I was so uncomfortable with myself. I didn't like who I was. I certainly wasn't comfortable in my home environment. I didn't trust my parents. And I was always looking for a way to escape. And as a kid, the only thing that I had to get me out of that was books. And so I like to say that I read books alcoholically, sort of tongue in cheek. Right. But what it was a way to get me out of reality. And as I got older, I kept looking for other ways to achieve that. And so when I got to high school, I discovered alcohol. And alcohol made me feel good about myself. It made me feel plugged in and accepted and okay for the first time ever in my life. And that was a wonderful feeling. I wanted that as much as possible. And so alcohol became my tool for me to feel good about myself. And I didn't understand that it wasn't solving my problems, that it was just a Band-Aid, because it worked for a long time. You know, up into my mid-20s, yeah. It did the job for me. But, you know, like all external things like that, it had diminishing returns over time. And so it just worked less and less and less until it stopped working altogether.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
And when did you, for you, I guess, when did you decide that this isn't working anymore? I need some help. I need to figure this out. I need to do something different.
I think by the time I was 26, 27, I knew that there was something seriously wrong. I always felt like there was something wrong with me, so that wasn't new. But I was really starting to think that I had, you know, I needed to check myself into an insane asylum or something, because I didn't feel like everybody else around me looked. And I lived and worked in an army town. And so all the guys I worked with were military. I'm prior service. And so it's a very, very drinking, toxic, masculine environment. So I didn't think that I was doing anything all that different from everybody else. I knew I drank more than most of the guys that I worked with. But I've always been the extremist, the guy on the outside end. So I didn't think that that was it. But I felt like, because I had all of these negative feelings on the inside that nobody else ever talked about, I thought there was something wrong with me. But it wasn't until I was 32 that I actually, through the help of a guy that I worked with, as a matter of fact, found my way into a recovery meeting. And that was the big page turner for me. I found a room full of people who talked about the way they felt and that it was bad. They didn't like themselves. And these are all the things they did to try to solve that. And it was the same list that I had of things that I'd tried to do. And that blew me away, because up until that point, I thought that it was just me and that there was something wrong with me because I have all these feelings on the inside and all of the guys around me don't ever show any of that stuff.
Well, that talks about that toxic masculinity. You know, don't share your feelings. You should be like this. You get that message.
You bet. Yeah. I mean, from being a small kid, you know, the day that you're running, you fall down, you scrape your knee, and your dad yells at you, "Don't, you know, big boys don't cry." And you learn to hold everything on the inside. And my dad didn't ever express anything other than rage his entire life. So I didn't have any understanding of what half of these other feelings were, much less how to handle them, how to deal with them. So, you know, by the time I became an adult, You know, I'm 23, 25, 28 years old running around with no understanding of how to be who I am. And I'm trying to be someone else to get some approval from people around me. And it's just, it's a disaster, especially, you know, when I'm 35 beers into a Saturday night. You know, there's no way that I'm going to be a normal functioning human being that knows how to handle his feelings. So that was my biggest problem, I think, that made me decide I had to quit drinking, was that the more I got drunk around other people, the more I misbehaved and just couldn't seem to control myself. And it was all of that stuff that I suppress all the time, you know, leaking out. I can't hold it together when I'm drunk. And a lot of the ways it came out was searching for affection. I needed affection so bad, I didn't know what to do with it.
Right.
So I would pursue any woman in the vicinity, despite the fact that I was in a long-term relationship. I would try to find acceptance and affection in everybody around me. And then the next day I would think about, oh God, I'm, you know, horrified at what I did last night. And the only thing that I could do to make that horrible feeling of guilt and just shame on the inside go away was to go home from work and get drunk again and make that go away. And it was just, it became a cycle.
And I imagine that feeling had been there for a long time, because you talk about a lot of the abuse that you suffered through your childhood, that wasn't necessarily a new feeling, that feeling of shame and that feeling of guilt, of worthlessness.
No, that I think that has been there all my life. I can't think back to a time when I didn't feel that way about myself. So it was the only way that I knew how to feel. It was the way that I knew myself to be. And had I known at any point in my life that I have the power to overcome that feeling and to change that feeling about myself, I think my life would have been drastically different. But I thought that I was just stuck with that that's who I was.
Right. Almost like you don't even know it. In your book, you describe a therapy session that you begin to have where you start to uncover some of these deeper feelings, some of these deeper sensations. At the time, maybe you didn't recognize them as feelings, but you start to discover that. Can you talk about that process a little bit?
It was such a fascinating experience for me going into therapy. And I did EMDR trauma therapy. And a lot of the point of that is to address childhood events and traumas and to change the way the emotions that we have tied to those memories. And so my therapist took me back to, you know, like the day standing in front of the wood pile and my dad standing there with the paddle, and we're counting how many pieces of wood are sticking out that I'm going to get whipped for. And that feeling of just helpless rage that I had at that moment was,
right.
kind of a defining feeling, but I was too young to understand what was really going on in that situation. And so adult with this perspective, I could look at that and say, you know, it's not the kid that had the shortcoming in the situation. It's not that 8-year-old kid wasn't good enough to stack the wood properly. It's that his dad didn't have the tools to support that kid properly and to tell him he did a good job and maybe you could straighten those out and it would be even better. But it took the help of my therapist for me to look at that with, you know, the 30,000 foot view on it and to understand the feelings that I had in that situation and understand what was really going on there. And that helped me change my perspective on it from me being a failure to me being okay. Like, I did all the things that I needed to do in that situation, and the shortcoming was on my dad. It wasn't on me. And that allows me to change my entire basis of self-belief, because it's that event times 10,000, right? So every one of those events that I thought I was the loser in that, and I didn't do it good enough, it turns out I did just fine. And so that's the life-altering experience for me, is that everything that I thought I knew about myself to be true was not true. And I get to rewrite that story.
And you get to feel differently about it.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And it takes some time on that. Like, I've been trained my entire life to feel a certain way about myself. So I still have the automatic knee-jerk reaction when I think about myself at various stages of my life or events or things that I did. But I have to remind myself in those moments that's not true. It's not a real feeling, and that I have new feelings about all of those things. And that's a gift that I could never repay. It has changed. I don't even know how to put it into words, like my confidence, my understanding of who I am and what I have always brought to this world, it changed everything.
Right. Being able to see it from that perspective. And I think so many of us can go through our life where we don't get that opportunity or we can't see it. It sounds like it almost started that first day you went into that recovery meeting and you saw these other men talk about feelings like, my gosh, they're feeling the same way I do. Maybe I'm not so alone in this.
That was the very first pinprick, I think, in my reality that eventually brought on the avalanche. But it took a lot of time then, too, because I had spent so much time reinforcing all of those negative self-beliefs. You know, I bought into it and I became part of the problem of just reinforcing all of the things that were horrible about me. And so understanding that there were other people that felt that way and that there was a way to get past that was a start. But it took years of hard work for me to get to various levels. Like it took me 5 years to be open-minded enough to even think about seeing a therapist. And,
right,
you know, had I tried to do that on day one, I wouldn't have had any success with it because I had to overcome a lot of, I don't even know the word for it, but I had so much prejudice against everything that was feel good and soft and fluffy and all of those things. I was trying to be a tough guy that I wasn't, right? And I tried to be Mr. Independent. I don't need anybody's help or anything.
Yeah, all that stuff is that toxic masculinity where, you know, mm-hmm. you're not allowed to have feelings. You're not supposed to express anything. You should just be stoic about it. And, you know, we buy into that idea that somehow we're flawed. And I would say maybe not buy into it because as children, in some ways, we don't necessarily understand that choice of buying into that belief. But, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, things happen to us. And when we're in that age, we start to take that on as an identity, especially those younger years.
Sure. I mean, in your formative years, you take everything from around you and you believe that to be true, right? And
right.
In my case, you know, my dad instilled in me right from day one that he is right. No matter what, my dad is right. And I can never question that. And the beliefs that I picked up from just being raised in that environment, I didn't question many of those most of my adult life. Like for little things from the way that my dad saw that when you eat a steak, it ought to be burned to a crisp. And that's how you eat a good steak. That was my belief. I burned all of my steaks all the way up until I was 35 years old. And then somebody finally talked me into having a medium rare steak and it blew my mind. It was amazing. It's like, oh my God, what else am I doing wrong? But you know, right. Little things like that, all the way to big things, you know, my opinion about politics and people who aren't like me and all of the big stuff, you know, all of those things I inherited from my parents and I never questioned them. And that's one of the things that changed for me once I got into recovery is I learned how to question those beliefs and change my mind about things and form my own opinions instead of just going with what I was programmed with.
Yeah. And you know, you've talked about how your dad had a ton of rage. That's all he could express. And so my question is about the title of your book, The Righteous Rage of a 10-year-old Boy. I want to hear about that, The Righteous Rage.
I've gone through, you know, the entire emotional arc, I think, in processing all this stuff and coming to terms with it. But in the beginning and up through the middle of identifying all the things that happened and why they happened, like I recognized that I got a raw deal and I have every reason in the world to be angry at my parents about that. Like I am justifiably hostile to my parents for what they did to me. But the closing end of that arc is that, yeah, I have reason to be angry, but that anger doesn't do anything positive for me. All it does is keep me burning up on the inside. And
right.
The true freedom comes in moving past that and letting go of that rage, even if it's justified, even if I got a raw deal and I got screwed, none of that matters because I can hold on to that until the day I die and I will have a miserable existence. But the true freedom comes in letting it go.
And that arc, sometimes we want to jump to the end of the arc. And just, walk to, you know, I'm just going to let it go. But I think sometimes that can end up being that kind of stoic masculinity. Well, I've let it all go. It's all fine, but it's really not.
No, if you haven't processed the stuff, it's not fine. And I think that that is a very common thing, that we want to go straight from the beginning to the end and skip the middle. But like all things in life, the journey is where it's at. You know, it's not the destination. It's all about the journey. So if you skip the journey, you're just shorting yourself.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And in your book, you talk about, I think it's in chapter 2, where you talk about that beginning process with the therapist of, let's dig a little bit deeper about that.
It's scary in the beginning. I think for most of us, I don't want to speak for other people. For me, the idea of talking about all of my innermost fears to someone else, especially a stranger, especially a girl, oh my God, like there, everything about that, you know, I was raised to believe was wrong. And so right. It was a big stepping out of the comfort zone to sit down with someone that's, and even beyond that, somebody that's 15 years younger than I am and hasn't had all the life experiences that I've had. And, you know, all of the things that I thought were prerequisites in order for her to help me, you know, she didn't have any of that stuff. She's young, she's a girl, and she wants to talk about my feelings and the things that I have hidden from everybody, the stuff that's buried the deepest. And it's hard to get over that initial hump. But once I realized that putting it all on the outside didn't change anything in a negative way, like someone else knowing all of my fears and my secrets and all the horrible things that I've done, it didn't make me feel worse about myself. It made me feel better. Like getting sunshine on that stuff was so healthy. But getting willing to do that is a whole nother matter. And I think that for most of us, we just have, the pain has to get greater than the fear. And right. That's how it was for me. You know, it hurt bad enough that I was willing to step into the fear. And I'm so grateful that I did.
Right. And then finding that that support that works for you.
Oh, yeah. Well, support is so important. And I think that's one thing that I give my wife a lot of credit for, is backing me up no matter what I needed to do while I went through this process and being willing to listen. And she didn't understand 3/4 of it. My wife had a great childhood. She has no concept of what it's like to grow up in a terrible emotional environment. So, you know, she did her best to be supportive in every way that she could. And that gave me the freedom that I needed to go pursue this. But also being supported by my therapist and her helping me understand that it's okay to have the feelings. It's okay for me to feel the feelings, that I don't need to do something to try to change those feelings, which has always been my MO.
Right.
Taking a drink to change the way I feel or smoking a cigarette to change the way I feel. I've never been okay with feeling feelings. And I've given up all of those tools. And now I'm trying to learn how to feel the feelings and be okay with them. And sometimes it hurts, but I've learned that that's okay too. It's part of it.
And what's so interesting, I find, is that a lot of times these other people around us, like you said, your wife and your therapist, can see the good in us that we can't see in ourselves because we're so wrapped into that story of trauma, shame, abuse.
Sure. I mean, when you think about our perspective on ourselves, and especially before I became, you know, self-aware, learned how to become self-aware and to think about what I'm doing and the impact that it has on people around me. But, you know, my focus on myself was on, you know, 3 or 4 big glaring things, and I never paid attention to the other 99.999% of who I am and the experiences that I bring to those around me. And I think that it's important to try to get past that and to grow that self-awareness and understand that other people don't have the same experience with us that we have with ourselves. They have what we put on the outside. We have what's on the inside.
Yeah. What motivated you to put pen to paper, to put this book out there, to now put it actually out in print?
I had a couple of reasons. The first was that while my childhood traumas are unique to me in some way, the insecurities and self-beliefs that I formed as a result of those experiences are the same that everybody else has. And the process that I went through to overcome that and change the way that I feel about myself is the same for everybody. And to me, that was so profound. I mean, for me to be able to go from a negative life experience to a positive life experience, and to go from self-loathing to self-love, like, I need to share that. It's my responsibility to share that with as many people as possible, because that's information that people need to have. I didn't know that stuff most of my life. And if I can help someone else realize that and change their experience, then that gives me some fulfillment. But it all started just as a journal, because I was having so many breakthroughs, and my realizations were just coming at me left and right, that I was afraid of forgetting some of that stuff. And so I started journaling it out. And by the time we were 6-8 months into it, that's when I realized that this is a book, and this is something that people need to have.
Right, that other people can relate to this and see this. I can share my story and that toxic shame, that toxic masculinity, maybe free someone else from that.
Yeah, definitely. And I will tell you, it's a step past, you know, I talked about the challenge of sharing my secrets with my therapist. And when I get on podcast interviews and talk about this stuff, and when people that I don't even know are reading my book, and I've put all my deepest, darkest secrets in there too, the more sunshine gets on those secrets, the less power they have over me. And that's an incredible feeling too. Like, you can't come at me with anything. I don't have anything to be afraid of, because I've already put it all out on the line. So there's nothing anybody else can throw at me. That's a pretty freeing thing in itself.
Yeah, it's freeing from that shame. And you know, shame is, I don't want to be seen. I can't be seen. I mm-hmm. don't look at me. And when it's all out there, there is like a huge amount of freedom to just be yourself and just be who you are.
That's right. And with the confidence that some people are going to love me for who I am, and some people are going to not love me for who I am. And it's okay either way. Like, that right. is such a change of attitude for me, you know, as a people pleaser. You know, my opinion of myself was so reliant on other people's opinions that I couldn't imagine taking that kind of a risk before I've managed to learn all this stuff. But now I don't have to worry about any of that, because my opinion comes from inside.
Right. That it's from you. And how has that impacted the rest of your life? I mean, you're also a business owner, an entrepreneur, and all of that. How has this changed all that?
In every way imaginable. But the biggest part is I have self-confidence. And so that changes the way I carry myself, the way that I address people, the way that I handle challenges at work, whether it's with a customer or an employee. Like, one of the chapters in the book addresses my inability to fire an employee. And, you know, I had an anxiety attack in the middle of that effort, trying to let somebody go that needed to be let go. I couldn't do it. I had to tap out and let my wife handle it. And which has only been maybe 3 weeks ago now, I fired somebody for the first time, and I did it by myself, and I handled it, and I walked through it. And that all by itself is such a huge change in my ability to do my job and to you know, fulfill the responsibilities that I have to protect my company. And
right,
you know, the positive things that come along with that too is my abilities as a leader to take the team through whatever situation we're facing. You know, I have the confidence that we're going to be able to get through this no matter what, and that there's nothing that can happen that's going to destroy me. I'm going to be okay with that. And that allows me to have a positive attitude that other people feed from. You know, people take their direction. If you have a negative leader, you're probably going to be a negative company. And so that has allowed me to be positive and confident, which has changed the whole culture of the workplace. And that's a big deal. But my relationship with my wife has improved too, because I don't have to prove myself over and over because I have this inferiority complex. Whereas, you know, I used to have to prove myself, or I felt like I had to prove myself every day. So not going through all that is, you know, frees up a lot of energy and a lot of time. And everybody has been around somebody who's constantly trying to prove themselves. Like, that's an annoying person. That's an exhausting person to be around. And I am grateful that I don't have those behaviors anymore.
Yeah. And you had talked earlier about some of the subtle things, like these changes of like being able to fire an employee or some of these other small things, just like the little things that you pick up in your relationship are different, but they're big victories when you can see them in the context of all of your own trauma.
the more pieces of my puzzle I get on the board, it's really fascinating. I can almost look at it from an outside perspective of seeing all of the various puzzle pieces and the progression of the path from going from a broken little boy into a broken man and into a healed man that's whole and emotionally healthy, or at least getting there. It has become a lifestyle for me. I find it very interesting to learn about myself and to figure out things that I want to change about myself and how I might go about doing that. But the positive impacts that it has on everyone else around me too, you know, the enthusiasm that people bring into a conversation with me, it gives my whole life more meaning and fulfillment. And I don't know. It's an amazing, amazing way to live.
Absolutely. Once you get past the fear of self-discovery, I mean, if you think about it, when we're in that trauma and that shame, we've been trying to hide that from everyone and hide it from ourselves. And to be able to walk into it when you have enough security in yourself, yeah, you get to really learn about yourself and know who you are. And it's not as scary anymore.
Right. You know, I think about this at least once a month. I remember sitting in the bathroom, probably, you know, when I was 27, 28 years old, sitting in the back bathroom, pounding down a six-pack of beer because somebody showed up at the house unexpectedly and I was sober and I could not possibly face somebody outside of work, you know, if I haven't got a little bit of beer to lubricate things. And just that feeling on the inside, that anxiety of just like everything is wrong, right? And I don't want to lose that feeling because that drove so much of my behavior, so much of my life. And I want to remember that as a measuring point on how far I've come, because that hiding from everybody all the time, like sometimes literally, sometimes figuratively, but it's exhausting. Like it's such a difficult lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so freeing to walk through that, but it's work and it's scary.
Definitely. It's definitely a lot of work. You know, as you can tell reading through the book, you know, it's an hour of a therapy session just figuring the stuff out. But then it's going home and stewing on it for a week or two and figuring stuff out and writing some things for me. In my case, I learn a lot about myself just writing things down because it allows my thoughts to expand. And then you're going back and doing the next session and then stewing on that for a couple of weeks. So it wasn't an overnight change for me. It's been, you know, several years in the making. But like I said earlier, you know, the journey of going through all of this, I think, is where the joy is at. If a switch got flipped and one day I went from miserable, the next day everything was amazing, I wouldn't have any way to appreciate why or how it happened or what it took for that to happen. So I think the slow, gradual process for me is satisfying in itself.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think when you find that joy and that, some of that serenity and some of that healing, there is just this natural tendency to want to give it to others who are suffering.
There is. And I think that's something that I picked up early in recovery programs, is that when you can witness someone else having a small triumph, like you get to take a part in that, because when you understand the struggle, you recognize how important the triumph is, even if it's minute. So being able to go through your own process, knowing that other people understand you and that you understand where they are. That's one of the basic human needs, is to be understood, right? And I think once you learn the elements of who you are and what makes you do what you do, then you have that understanding, and that enables you to have empathy for yourself as well as for other people.
Absolutely. And I think that there's so many people out there that can help you in that journey, can help anybody who's struggling in that journey, that want to listen, want to understand.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that makes recovery groups so successful, is that it's a group of people who are on the same journey and have experienced the same pain. And it's hard to find that in many other places in society. And I think that, you know, we would benefit as a whole if people could be more open about their challenges rather than trying to keep the good face on all the time.
Yeah, that facade of like, I'm okay, everything's fine, I got it all under control, it's all good. Don't look at me. Don't look too close.
Yeah, because there are those of us out there that are naive enough to believe that. when we compare our insides to other people's outsides, you know, we lose every time. So I think it's really important to know that no matter how bad you're struggling, you're certainly not alone. And when you're seeing other people that seem like they've got it all together, you just don't know them very well. You haven't spent enough time with them, because we all have challenges to some level.
Absolutely. Justin, I want to say, like, I'm glad you chose to put your whole self out there so that other people could see it and learn and grow. I think that's an amazing and wonderful thing. We're coming up on our time, but before I wrap up, I usually like to ask like one question, and that's like, if anybody's out there listening and you could say one thing, what would you want it to be?
Be willing to change your mind about everything that you believe, because you could be wrong.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. How can people find you?
You can find everything you need to know about me at my website at jboydlong.com. I've got all my books on there. I've got a blog with a lot of self-help discussions and things that I've learned about myself in there. It's a lot of good stuff. So jboydlong.com.
Oh, thank you, Justin, so much for coming on to the Addicted Mind podcast. I appreciate you sharing your story and just being part of the podcast.
Thanks for having me on the show. It's been great.
All right, everyone. Thank you for listening to the Addicted Mind podcast. As usual, all the show notes will be at theaddictedmind.com. So check that out. And if you're enjoying the Addicted Mind podcast, please write us a review in iTunes. That really does help people find the podcast, and I really appreciate it. Also, think about joining our Facebook group. Just go to Facebook and type in the Addicted Mind podcast and click join. You can continue the conversation online. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for supporting the Addicted Mind. I really do appreciate it. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. And I will talk to you on the next episode.
It's Erin.
And I'm Michaela, and we're the hosts of the Two Sober Girls podcast, and we are on a mission to spill the wild truth about sobriety.
Forget the rosé all day cliche. Sobriety is flipping amazing.
Absolutely. It's not just about quitting the drink. It's a gift you give yourself and your loved ones.
So what are you waiting for? Break up with that old toxic relationship with alcohol and let us show you the possibilities.
And here's the thing. Everything your precious heart desires becomes way easier without the influence of alcohol.
We're not just two sober girls. We're also wellness coaches. We're here to show you how to optimize health, lifestyle, and beauty, feel sexy and alive as F.
So stay tuned, because we're rolling out new episodes every Monday wherever you get your podcasts. And trust us, they have your name written all over them. We can't wait to share the magic of sobriety and wellness with you. Subscribe to Two Sober Girls podcast today and come follow us on Instagram for behind the scenes action, and send us a DM. We can't wait to meet you.